Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I think basically what I feel about what is happening in South Asia and is that the present administration, as the former administration, keeps expecting the Afghans and the Pakistanis and even the Indians to do what is good for us. You all noted that both Hillary Clinton and Richard Holbrooke announced firmly that the aim of the United States was the destruction of the Taliban. Now, I assume they get some word of reaction. The Pakistanis, even kind of secular Pakistanis that most of us know, took very badly to this reaction that Americans' aim was to destroy the Taliban, just as Americans would take it very badly if somebody from the outside world announced that they were going to destroy the Christian right in this country. Because when all is said and done, as the Pakistanis keep insisting and reacting to that, Pakistan is constitutionally an Islamic country. Nobody in Pakistan ever disputes this, nor do they ever dispute that the Constitution says what has been codified is that Pakistan is an Islamic country and that their intention is to make Sharia fully the law of the land. That has never been repealed from Zia's time. Now, the difficulty is that we have been asking the Afghans and the Pakistanis to agree with what we like. That is, we would like the Pakistanis to fight the Taliban. We insisted that the Pakistani army go into SWAT and, as we put it, drive out the Taliban. The result, as you know from newspaper accounts, is 2 million refugees have fled from SWAT and are living in frightful conditions in Pakistan. But our argument was clear that it serves our interest to fight the Taliban, whatever the Taliban is. In the same way, certain things suit our interests in Afghanistan. Now, I think we got where we are by assuming that in our relations with Pakistan especially, it should serve our interests. Now, the Indians have been very fortunate. From the very beginning, the Indians made clear that they were not going to serve our interests. They were going to serve their own interests. Pakistanis have not been as forthright. Strobe Talbot tells when he was in Pakistan, the foreign minister of Pakistan saying to him, "If you Americans will just tell us what you want us to do, we will do it." Talbot was surprised, as he should have been, at this statement from the foreign minister, but it said something about our relations with Pakistan. And Benazir Bhutto, you recall, not long when she was back in this country, somebody asked her, "Why have you switched your position? Why are you now supporting Musharraf?" Her answer was, "Because the Americans asked me to." And we all know that was true. Now, I'm telling these stories because I think this is the answer of how we got where we are in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, is we have made an enormous mistake in thinking that the interests of Pakistan and Afghanistan are the same as ours. Now, that is why, in a way, I am anti-American. I think the present administration has followed faithfully the Bush line and sending 100,000 troops to Afghanistan. At least there's one phrase that has been dropped from the Obama's administration's line. Bush always stressed that they were going to stabilize the country, establish democracy, and work for economic and social improvement. Those phrases have been dropped from the Obama rhetoric. There's no longer mention that we were going to establish democracy or work for social and economic improvement. More realistic, perhaps, but still, most importantly, serving our interests. For many of us, the crucial years dealing with Pakistan, 1950s, when John Foster Dulles went to Pakistan and India, he disliked India. He especially disliked Nehru. He found him weak, a kind of person who didn't know right from wrong. He got to Pakistan and he met a general, later to become much more famous, General Ayub. He was charmed with Ayub. He said, he's a manly, religious fellow, unlike Nehru. And according to Dennis Cox, I can't find this in the actual record, John Foster Dulles said, we must have Pakistan on our side, so we'll have the Gurkhas on our side, because the Gurkhas are great fighters. And some of his entourage said, Mr. Dulles, the Gurkhas are in the Indian army. And Foster Dulles alleged to have said, no matter, we'll get them on our side. Now, in a way that sums up the troubles, to go back to what I just said, is that we expect Pakistan, and I think Pakistan is the key here, not Afghanistan, we expect Pakistan to be on our side. Now, when John Foster Dulles and the others were making the arrangements to aid Pakistan, there was never any doubt in the mind of the Pakistani leaders why we wanted American aid. Pakistan wanted American aid in order to build up an army to fight India. And I think we are fooling ourselves if we think that wasn't the intention then and why the Pakistanis wanted help. Now, we knew why we were helping the Pakistanis. It was to fight Soviet Union, to fight communism. And, of course, Nehru had no interest in this, so he was no hope. But the Pakistanis went along with the idea that they would be on our side. And then, as now, Pakistan has very different interests in the American alliance. And fighting the Taliban and fighting al-Qaeda, I don't think, those are not high on the objectives of Pakistan. I think India is still number one on Pakistan's objective. India, of course, is now high on our list. And as you know, there are many people in Washington who know we are in difficulty with Pakistan as an ally. And the hope, I think it's fair to say, in the Obama administration is that India will replace Pakistan as our ally in South Asia. I think that is the underlying motif in our relationship with South Asia. And in conclusion, I want to say, as a well-wisher of India, I hope that India will not replace Pakistan as our principal ally in South Asia. Thank you.
I think the question of how we got here historically would start with the partition of South Asia. Therefore, I'll take us back to 47. I think the partition itself was a terrible mistake. I think it was a mistake that has left a legacy of conflict between India and Pakistan that has continued now for almost 62 years. And I think that the genesis of partition, which has many roots, its immediate cause, and this is something that I dealt with in my last book, which is called Shameful Flight, was Lord Mountbatten's accelerated compulsion to get the job done as quickly as possible. The Attlee cabinet had sent him out with a mandate to try to resolve the conflict between the Congress Party and the Muslim League, and to do so ideally by transferring power to a single confederation. That single confederation, incidentally, had been drafted by Stafford Cripps, predominantly in 1946, as the solution of the cabinet mission, which was led by Secretary of State at the time, Patrick Lawrence. Mountbatten had been given until June of 1948 to resolve the conflict. He got there and quickly decided that it was much too difficult to get Nehru and Jinnah to agree, and therefore that the best thing to do was to cut through the Punjab as well as Bengal, create a new state bifurcated of Pakistan, and let the chips fall where they may. He was appealed to by the men who understood the situation best at the time, both Mahatma Gandhi and Jinnah, to wait and not to rush, but he insisted that the sooner the better. He was adrenaline-driven in everything that he did. He really knew nothing about the situation, but decided that he would take action as quickly as possible, and so he put through a plan on June 3rd to partition South Asia in 10 weeks called out Cyril Radcliffe to draw the new maps, and Radcliffe didn't know anything about India. He'd never been on the ground in either Punjab or Bengal. And, of course, he had to decide the final line in each case because there were two Muslim League and two Congress jurists who were given the job of assisting him. They both came down on different sides, so Radcliffe had to draw the line in the middle. And what he did was to listen ultimately to Mountbatten, who became Governor General of India in the first instance, and to give, for example, Gurdaspur to India so that they could have access by land to Kashmir. And the Kashmir conflict, as you know, continued from October of 1947 and continues to exercise both nations in a negative manner, and therefore part of the problem that we're faced with in South Asia today is the problem of conflicting states. And I think that this problem should be solved as quickly as possible, since both of these states now are nuclear armed, and that is a problem that has a dimension beyond the dimension of the Cold War days when we were confronting the Soviet Union, and we had, of course, more nuclear arms, but we were further away. So that within 10 minutes, either India or Pakistan can launch missiles which could destroy their major cities. I won't go into that at greater length because I hope nobody in his right mind would ever do that. But the reason that the Taliban are a problem, Ainsley, and I think they are our problem, and I think they are Pakistan's problem, is that the Taliban are crazy enough, if they do get hold of these bombs, to use them, just as I think there are certain members of India's right wing and BJP who would similarly take an action of that kind and would have done so after the Mumbai terror, which was so horrible last Thanksgiving, and which, of course, wisely was not followed up by a nuclear launch. And therefore, I think Manmohan has rightly won this enormous electoral victory because he has the confidence of his own people that he will behave with restraint. that he is not a madman, that he is not a wild card or a shooter from the hip, as Narendra Modi is, and that his behavior has led to a cooling of the hatred that was generated in the aftermath of that Mumbai massacre, which was again something that was carried out by the Lashkar-e-Taiba and their minions, and that are connected with the ISI in Pakistan. Now, Pakistan has indeed benefited from our support, and I think much of the problem that we're faced with today is and can be laid to our own doorstep, because getting back to the time of Ziaul Haq, who as you know, was the chief of army staff at the time that Zulfi Bhutto was the elected prime minister of the country, decided that Zulfi Bhutto had to hang because he was too popular and guilty, supposedly, of murder. The Punjab majority of the court agreed with Zia, and Zia ignored all of the pleas of people the world over, including Jimmy Carter, to give Bhutto a chance to live and maybe send him off into exile, as Musharraf recently did with Nawaz, rather than killing him, because Musharraf also claimed, of course, that Nawaz had been guilty of trying to murder him and all the people in his plane, letting it run out of gas before it could land in Karachi. But he had the good sense to let Nawaz go to Saudi Arabia, and Nawaz is now back in Pakistan and has now been allowed by the intelligent Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who's been returned to his position, Iftikhar Chaudhry, to run for office and should and probably will or may become the next Prime Minister of Pakistan. Now, all of that, again, is an indication of the problem that followed Ziaul Haq's assassination, judicial hanging of Zulfi Bhutto when he took power. He became the arch enemy of the Russian invaders of Afghanistan. Remember what Jimmy Carter initially said when he was president and after the Russians invaded in late 79 was that he would give Pakistan $400 million to fight the Russians. And Zia became a hero of his own country because he said that was peanuts. Well, Jimmy Carter lost the election, as we know, and he was replaced by a grade B actor named Ronald Reagan, who became our president and then gave Pakistan $10 billion. All of you know that story from what you've seen in the movie or read in the book about Charlie Wilson's war. And you know that when those missiles, the new Stinger missiles, were sent to Pakistan, they were able to shoot down not only the Russian helicopters, but also blow up all the Russian tanks. And in the process of fighting the Russians, what Zia did was to also support and train tens of thousands of mujahideen, as they were called, these Afghan refugees who came pouring into Pakistan. There are still 3 million of them there today. At the time, there were over 5 million. They were living in these camps similar to the camps that now have been set up for the poor refugees from Swat. But remember, they were trained and they were armed by us, by the CIA, by the groups that were righteously going to fight and destroy the Soviet Union in any way possible, because the Soviet Union had stepped beyond the bounds of the Cold War. They had intruded themselves into Afghanistan, and everybody said, well, this is a replay of the great game. The Tsars are coming back, and they're hammering at the gates of Delhi soon. So that it was recognized that this was a terrible global danger, recognized practically by everyone. Of course, India absolved or abstained in the United Nations attack on the Soviet Union at the time, because India was still quite friendly to the Russians diplomatically. But when we sent in all the money and all the weapons, which were so eagerly grasped by Zia and used, They did the job. The Russians finally gave up. The Soviet Union collapsed. But Zia didn't want to stop. Zia said, we've got to continue because we've now got them on the run. And he had this self-righteous Islamic belief that the Russians were part of this evil empire, as Ronald Reagan did. And this evil empire had to be destroyed at all costs. Zia, as you know, continued to insist that he didn't care that the Russians had stopped fighting. He wanted to chase them back to Moscow. But when he got on a plane in Bahawalpur, that was his presidential plane, much to his surprise, he went down in flames. Soon after, it took off and took most of the general staff of Pakistan with him at the time. Now, that mysterious destruction of Zia, who was the one, incidentally, who introduced the concept of Islamic rule to Pakistan, that had never been the belief of the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who was a good barrister, great barrister, who believed in really a much more secular form of Islam. He never had any strong religious training or feeling, and contemned the idea of theocracy. When he was asked, did he want a theocracy, was he envisioning a theocracy, he said never. What he envisioned was a nation state that would be modern, democratic, and that would have all of the connections to the modern world. And that's the thing that I think worries us about the Taliban. Taliban want to get back to Zia's fanatical and narrow-minded Islam, a form of Islam which is denied and which is repudiated by most of the leaders of Pakistan today, because they are modern intellectuals. You all know them. We all know them. They are people who would prefer to have what we would call a polity of liberal democracy which has relations of an amicable kind with the rest of the world. And the rest of the world, remember, doesn't just include us. Of course we are supporting Pakistan, but the most important neighbor of Pakistan is India. And India's power, India's wealth, India's success, and that miracle in part of economic globalization development is thanks to Manmohan Singh and what he was able to do as the Minister of Finance during the time of a predecessor. And what we have now is the need for India and Pakistan to reconcile their differences over Kashmir, and I hope that will happen soon. I hope that Pakistan will recognize that the best thing that they can possibly do is to accept the line of control that they currently have, make that the international border, stop fighting, and allow India to pull back its 500,000 or more troops from that region, and allow Pakistan also to stop wasting its money on lobbing these weapons out of Sajan, the highest glacier. What in the world are they doing up there anyway? It's crazy. And it's a waste of money, it's a waste of time. And I think that the important thing that has to be done now is to deal with the Taliban, because the Taliban are a real threat and danger. I'm sorry, Ainsley, but I must disagree strongly with you on the Taliban. There are Taliban who have not only prevented women from going out without covers, without burqas, have whipped them, young girls in public, have closed down and destroyed most of the women's schools that they have found in any of the districts that they've been in, have taken people who they dislike and beheaded them and then put their bodies upside down, hanging in the streets so that everyone could see what is the danger of denying Islamic Sharia law. And that is, incidentally, again, only a portion of the Islamic faith. It is not the majority of the Islamic faith. And I think that they have to be dealt with. If they will not surrender, if they will not stop fighting, I think that they have to be dealt with by the military. Ideally, there are some of them who have the brains or who are young enough to see that if they can stop fighting, they will be given a degree of not only security but opportunity. And the opportunity must be presented to Pakistan as a whole. The madrasa schools are no longer good enough for education of Pakistan's youth. Schools have got to change. They've got to become schools that teach modern science, that teach about the real world, and not just the world of the Quran as it is presented to them and memorized by them. I think that's going to be a difficult process, and I think that the reason that we're all here is to figure out the formula of how to get away from here, and thanks to Mark and his ingenious group of students and supporters, as soon as that plan is finished, Mark, I'm sure it will be sent to the president, and he will accept it and take it with him and save South Asia from itself and from the problems that have ensued.
Let me make three comments that connect what I want to say with what Ainslie and Stanley have already said. I think that Stanley's comment about the partition as a legacy, a sort of dark legacy of the British Empire, is a very important and often overlooked point. And everywhere, almost everywhere that Britain left, they left behind a divided polity with tragic results. If you think about Cyprus, Ireland, and of course Palestine. And it was a way that solved the British problems at home, but left for the former colonial people a terrible challenge that often has resulted in disaster. I also wanted to underscore Ainslie's emphasis on American myopia, the inability to take seriously the otherness of these very deep Asian cultures. And I was reminded of another comment that John Foster Dulles made while he was Secretary of State, which was that he could never understand why the Palestinians and Israelis could not sit down like good Christians and solve their problems. And finally, the disagreement about the Taliban. To me, the issue is not one of underestimating the humanitarian and human rights challenge posed by the Taliban, but it's rather, to what extent can this issue be addressed by military force from emanating from Washington and from outsiders? Are these issues in the post-colonial world addressable by counterinsurgency methods? And to me, that's a very decisive and central point. It's not one of, in any sense, underestimating the menace posed to human values by a movement like the Taliban, but it's really how to think about a constructive response to that menace and how to conceive of that response in a manner that doesn't inflict even worse suffering on the target society, or the society that is at risk. Now, I want to use my few minutes to focus on a critical look at U.S. policy toward Afghanistan, Pakistan, particularly, and India indirectly. And I think that a very important aspect of this, of my criticism of what has been happening under the Obama presidency, is a failure to distinguish between Obama's rejection of the grand strategy of the neoconservatives, particularly as embodied in the Middle East policies centered on the war in Iraq, and his essential acceptance of Bush's response to 9/11 by way of a war on terror, even if it's not called that at the present time. In other words, the criticism of the Bush approach was essentially that it got off track by entering Iraq and overlooking the real crux of the 9/11 threat, which was situated in Afghanistan. And a lot of what has followed really derives, in my view, from that distinction, namely the commitment to get out of Iraq, but at the same time to escalate the military involvement with Afghanistan. See, two kind of seemingly opposite moves, but they express that Obama distinction between rejecting neocon grand strategy but pursuing a even more vigorous and focused counterinsurgency, counterterrorist foreign policy. And that is coupled and, in my view, made more dangerous by having accepted the guidance, the essential guidance as to how to deploy American power that has been provided by General David Petraeus's rewriting of counterinsurgency doctrine and practice. And in that light, this book that I have with me, the Counterinsurgency Field Manual, authored by General Petraeus, and leading to his ascendancy in the American military establishment, is very important because what it does is to give a more, seemingly more acceptable way of conducting foreign interventions, foreign military interventions. It is a way of trying to humanize counterinsurgency warfare, which is, in my view, a rather unacceptable oxymoron. It isn't susceptible in the 21st century of being humanized. And the prestige and guidance of General Petraeus, who incidentally was my student at Princeton, and I like and respect him, but his role in this present setting is, I'm afraid, leading the U.S. in a very wrong direction. And there's also, it's quite interesting that the humane spin given to counterinsurgency in the manual is not being exhibited in the actual operations within Afghanistan at the present time. And that's, I think, highlighted by this intensification of reliance on drone airstrikes across the border in Pakistan. Again, something that Obama in his campaign promised to do more of as a way of establishing his national security credibility. And what that has seemingly done, and others may disagree with this interpretation, is to actually contribute disastrously to the destabilization of Pakistan, the further destabilization of Pakistan, and to the partial Talibanization of Pakistan. It has pushed the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda elements deeper into the, from the frontier area into the Pakistan heartland, and has created this real threat to the stability and even the survival of a government that has some at least moderate superficial orientation, though lacking in real legitimacy within its own society. So my sense, in putting it maybe in an overly historical way, is that the United States has failed to learn two of the essential lessons of the Vietnam War, and is repeating in a new set of modalities the mistakes that were made then. The first of these mistakes, I think, can be highlighted by a very famous conversation between an American military historian and commander, Harry Summers, and a Vietnamese colonel at the very end of the war. And Summers said to, is quoted as saying to Colonel Tu, the Vietnamese, he said, "You know, you never defeated us on the battlefield." And Colonel Tu replied, "Yes, that's true, but it's irrelevant." And it's that irrelevance that we have not understood in any operationally or doctrinally relevant way. We've constantly tried to convince ourselves that foreign military intervention is a feasible means in the post-colonial world of promoting national interests. And there is not a single success story behind that policy, and yet it continues. And the second unlearned lesson is the lesson of time, that even though the adversaries in these settings are militarily unable to contest the intervening power, they have a much longer cycle of endurance that in the end is what is likely to shape the political outcome of these conflicts. I remember again in the Vietnam context that the Vietnamese would always show foreign visitors to Hanoi a 50-year scenario for what they would do if the United States persisted in the war. But the intervener has much shallower commitment to the policies, much less fortitude, and therefore, if it can't win quickly, it tends to abandon the project. And that again happened in Vietnam. A final point about this is that the reliance on hyper-modern warfare, I think epitomized in the Afghanistan context by the reliance on these drone attacks, is extremely alienating to the population that is supposedly being protected. First of all, it produces lots of innocent civilian casualties. That it is a self, it is a delusional aspect of this kind of tactic to call it collateral damage, because it undermines the whole claim that this is a policy designed for the benefit of the people that are being protected. And what has happened now in Afghanistan, and hasn't been noticed very much, but I think is quite extraordinary, is that Washington's hand-picked leader, Karzai, has implored the U.S. government to stop these air attacks and has denounced them. See, which is quite extraordinary if you think about the politics of such a posture from someone like Karzai. So let me end by saying that I think the only way of responding to these developments in Afghanistan and Pakistan particularly is to respect the ethos of self-determination and to recognize that only that respect, which doesn't mean a total disengagement, but it does mean a demilitarization of the engagement and a respect for indigenous traditions, conflict resolution modalities, and a realization that what is wanted in Washington may not correspond with what is wanted by the peoples living in the countries, which is really, I think, Ainslie's main point also. And that in the to the extent that the U.S. has economic and diplomatic leverage, it should certainly be used to encourage Indian-Pakistan reconciliation. And that kind of prospect can only be achieved effectively if it's coupled with this abandonment of a counterinsurgency approach to the conflicts in the region. And nothing, let me end with this, nothing is more discouraging from my point of view than the replacement of General McKerney by this new general, McChrystal, who has a reputation for two things. One is Green Beret style tactics of counterinsurgency, and the other, the administration of the prison in Afghanistan that had the absolutely worst human rights record, worse than the more well-known Bargham prison, a man that apparently sanctioned the most extreme forms of torture while under his command. And for Obama to be so under this sway of Petraeus as to take his advice and appoint this kind of general is a very discouraging development that I don't think we should overlook. Thank you very much.
I actually want to start off with coming back to with a question that comes back to the large issue of how we got to this point, and turn to our two historians and ask how it is that the U.S. came to replace the Britain as sort of the upholder of Western values in the region and the intrusive military presence. And was it simply because of a particular national interest, or is there something larger in the kind of frame of Pax Americana that has led to this kind of omnipresent force of American political and military reality in the region. Stanley? And
well, I think it's just that we won the war. After World War II, we came into the position that Britain held before. Mm-hmm. And I think the it was clear that Churchill, despite the fact that he was the most popular wartime leader, had lost the confidence of his own people, that the Labour government came in, that they were in favor of eliminating empire, which was a good idea, and that they therefore no longer had the appetite for defending or for changing or for modifying everybody in the rest of the world. And we became, in a sense, the policemen of the world, which, as we now know, of course, is a ridiculous thing to try to be. And what we just heard from Richard is exactly correct, that we can't not only control everybody, but we can't do it by massive military use of power, and especially air power and heavy modern technology. Mm-hmm. But we have that illusion, mm-hmm, that we could do anything because we had so much success militarily during the war and we had so much money after the war. Mm-hmm. And now that we've lost all of that, maybe we'll become more humble.
Mm-hmm. Ainsley?
I just wanted to... Sorry. Footnote to Richard. He said more eloquently than I did what I meant to say. Just a word about Petraeus. It's worth remembering that behind Petraeus, in articulating his views and insurgency, is an extraordinary man called David McKilcullen, who was an Australian. He's just written a book. And David Kilcullen got many of his ideas of counterinsurgency from working in Northwest and in Afghanistan. He's a great admirer of the British in the 19th century. And Kilcullen said the only way to win is the way the British maintained. Kilcullen has no illusion about democracy and the condition of women and that sort of thing. He believes you must control it. Very able man, very affable man. But I share what Richard said about Petraeus, but Petraeus, both in Iraq and now in Afghanistan, is depending very much on Kilcullen's way of belief in insurgency. No nonsense of democracy, no nonsense of condition of women and so on. We're there to win, and I think he's wrong, but that's what he's talking about.
And, of course, the question is what winning means. Lloyd?
Well, you asked, you know, go back, and how did we get to pick up the British, mm-hmm, mission, shall we say, in South Asia. I think very quickly I'd like to mention a gentleman named Sir Olaf Caro, who was the last foreign secretary of the British government of India, who wrote a book published in 1939, Wells of Power, which was that the most important geopolitical thing in the world was the Middle East oil. And Sir Olaf, I'm collapsing a big story, which, by the way, is in that article that I sent around, came to the U.S., met Henry Boyrod, who was Assistant Secretary of State for Middle East, South Asia at the time, convinced him that Olaf Caro's idea that we had to have a northern tier, that the Soviets were coming to seize the oil in the Middle East, and we had to do something about it. So he invented what became CENTO, and he Boyrod went to John Foster Dulles. So the beginning of the containment policy which for the Middle East oil, and which included South Asia, was now Olaf Caro distrusted and disliked Nehru. He wrote a book about the Pathans. He loved their poetry and so forth. He was very much the Muslims were great fighters and great people. Nehru was a socialist and couldn't be counted on. So he put Pakistan in the middle of this containment policy for the Middle East. And that's what Boyrod and Dulles constructed. We got CENTO, of course, we got CETO. And so that's how America came to be in supporting, that used Pakistan in its containment policy. Pakistan used the U.S. to arm itself to be equal to India and to, you know, be able to take on India if necessary.
So a combination of interests of containment in the Cold War and oil. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, Suzanne?
I'm going to bring the...
Wait a second, we have to wait for the microphone. This just now coming, as we say in India.
I very much agree with most of what Richard Falk was saying. As leaving home and reading the last headline about the fact that we were about to send in massive increased troop levels into Pakistan, into Afghanistan, I found very frightening because it's impossible to control those kinds of troop levels from continue the kind of havoc that troop levels have already wrought in Afghanistan. What makes me pause, however, is his remark toward the end that not only that we have to respect the ethos of self-determination, which I agree with, but that it means that we cannot disengage, but we do have to demilitarize. I see a possibility of Afghanistan in several years demilitarized and fully Talibanized. In some ways, we have prepared a road for ourselves that we will not stand for Talibanization, and we have said that they won't stand for Talibanization. But we're in some ways going to interpret self-determination as meaning we will know what your true self-determinated policy ought to be. I'm not clear how we're going to demilitarize and not resist Talibanization at the same time. I'd like to have Richard take some position on that.
Cynthia Mahmood.
Yes.
And welcome. We're so delighted that you're
Thank
here.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm delighted to be here, too. This is to Richard Falk, with whom I agreed on practically everything, but about the Petraeus volume, which I have been offered to help revise. Maybe some others of you have also had these kinds of invitations. One of the interesting things about that volume, aside from the different ways it's been received within the military and outside the military, is the way in which development agencies, aid agencies, stray scholars are treated as force multipliers of the military in regions where we are fighting counterinsurgencies. They're tied into the overall U.S. military effort because they're the agents of culture, basically. And, you know, I see this as a really great danger of that manual and that strategy, that any humanitarian worker should be perceived as part of the U.S. military effort. So I was tempted enough to think to get involved with a liaison from the U.S. military to try to ensure the independence, in fact, of humanitarian and aid workers from U.S. military efforts. But I just bring this up as a potential later topic, the discussion about the ethics of involvement of academicians with the U.S. military and the human terrain system that you may have heard about, which my professional association has condemned, the American Anthropological Association. And tied to that, you all may, as I have received many more invitations from the Obama administration than we have from the Bush administration to give policy advice on these matters and other matters. But my question to you, Richard, is, I agree with you that Obama has not quite seen the light about that what he's doing in Afghanistan is not consistent with a lot of others of his views. And some advice as to who do we go to, you know, how do we get to him or as close to him as we can to convey our insights.
Richard, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, let me say two things. One about the counterinsurgency manual. And I think I accept completely your point. And I disagree slightly what Ainslie said. It is true that Kilcullen, is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he is recited quite a bit in the manual, but the spirit of the manual is exactly the opposite of what he proposes.
He's an anthropologist, yes.
Well, but see, the way in which Petraeus and his colleagues tried to sell counterinsurgency was that it did do the democratizing and humanitarian work. That the argument there that they make is it cannot succeed unless it brings a humane democracy and leaves that in its as its legacy. And in that sense, there's a real disconnect between the policies and this doctrinal statement. And one of the disconnects that's very interesting is that they say, if you are going to engage in counterinsurgency, you need 20 counterinsurgents for every 1,000 members of the population to be effective. That would mean upwards of 700,000 foreign troops in Pakistan, it would mean 3.5 million. So it partly exhibits, just from a clear political point of view, the non-viability, the domestic non-viability of successful counterinsurgency, even taking the doctrine in its own terms, that it's just not viable domestically in the United States to think of sending 700,000 Americans or allies, that you couldn't recruit the allies, much less dealing with Pakistan. I mean, it's an absurdity. And the other point that I wanted to respond to was, I'm not sure, I have another student, Anne-Marie Slaughter, who's the head of the policy planning staff in the State Department, and might be, she, because that's sort of the conceptualizing. That position can either be very influential, as it was when George Kennan was the director of the policy planning staff, or virtually irrelevant. And it depends a lot on the relationship between the person holding the job and the Secretary of State and President. And I have no insight into that.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.